Hey, hey everybody. So theory, I'll put in quotes. So most of what I do is actually, I consider myself more of an observer, I think. I mostly do data analysis and things like that, but we are gonna get a bit of a background in gravitational wave theory first to sort of set the stage and cover some of the observational results later on. So first of all, I also know that I am what's keeping you from lunch. So we'll see how things go. Make sure everyone's paying attention. I've got some, if we'll switch gears, if it gets too boring, I can do some in-class exercises and we'll keep everyone busy. But without further ado, I'll go ahead and get started. So my goal essentially is to give everyone a big picture overview of certainly the theory behind gravitational waves, but really from an angle of what makes LIGO important. So LIGO sources specifically, and how we sort of know what we know when we talk about LIGO observations. So my goal is, if any of you walk into a LIGO seminar at some point, a colloquium at university or whatever, and you see some things up there, that you'll hopefully have a deeper understanding of what some of it means and be able to be a little bit more engaged. How many people have studied gravitational waves? Several, okay, great. So then a lot of the stuff in the beginning is gonna be probably background. For many of you that you've already had. How many people have seen LIGO seminars?
LIGO
seminars, like talks. So you mostly are familiar with results and things like that. Okay, good. Well, let's go ahead and get started. All right, so this is the outline. I'm going to cover, so I'll start with what are gravitational waves. And I'll do this just from a perspective of linearized gravity. Which is more than sufficient for what we are gonna be talking about. I will talk about sort of idealized sources of GWs. And then, importantly, some predictions of amplitude. That'll give you a sense of where the field was before it really became an experimental field, before we started building these, you know, enormous gravitational wave detectors. So we sort of had in hand roughly how we thought things were going to go, and I'll give you an overview of that. So after that, we're going to get on to, can people see if I write in the lower half of the board? I can raise it some. All right. All right. So we'll go on to compact binaries. And essentially, this is the only gravitational wave source I'm going to go into any detail about. As probably all of you know, it's, of course, what LIGO has been successful with. We've not detected any other sources of gravitational waves. There are lots of other things that could cause gravitational waves. We could talk about them over coffee or whatever at some point, but I figure there's not much point in going into that with our limited time. So we'll talk about the sort of binary in spiral driven by gravitational radiation. And give an example of a famous example of a pulsar. Nope, 1913. A binary pulsar that was discovered, I guess, in the early 70s. It's famous in our field for having really been the first indirect evidence of gravitational wave emission. Let's talk a bit about that system. And I'll also give a little bit of an overview. Essentially based on some of these results and other results of how we predict the rate of binary mergers and essentially how we came to know what LIGO would be expected to see. All right, so I don't know if we'll get this far today, but next we'll be extracting physics from binaries. So we'll talk a bit about the general formulation for estimating binary parameters and what that tells us about the what we can learn from the binaries through gravitational waves. I'll talk a little bit more about, you know, more detail about some of the parameters that affect dynamics in compact binary systems. And if we get this far today, we'll do a fun exercise of chirp mass by I. So the first gravitational wave detection, it turns out that it was so astonishingly loud, you can actually see it in the data. And with the stuff you will have learned by the time we get here, we'll actually work out a simple relationship to figure out the chirp mass just by drawing lines and counting periods and things like that. So we'll see if we get that far today. I brought a bunch of examples with me so you all can work through it. And we'll move on basically then to sort of a general formalism with Bayesian inference. And I will give some sense of the typical uncertainties in measurements. Okay, so after that, we will talk about gravitational wave searches, and it's in some sense a little out of order, because historically in the field, we've talked about searches before we've talked about parameter estimation. But now that we have signals, of course, people want to know specifically what it is that we're seeing. But I'm gonna tell you a little bit about how we get to that part. I think this is important because hidden in here, in many ways, are a lot of the selection effects that are sort of implicit in LIGO's results. So I think having a somewhat reasonable understanding of how this works may help you gauge, you know, when we see something or when we don't see something, what sort of filter has that process gone through. So we'll cover matched filtering briefly. And a little bit on dealing with non-stationary noise, which will make more sense when we get there. This is a, let's, all right. Yeah, I know, right? And assessing significance. Okay, so we will end
there's a hockey stick somewhere you can weight it.
Yeah, that just the hockey stick is enough to keep it down.
To keep it down, okay. Thanks.
If you ever want to get one that's too high up, they have all the little cords dangling inside.
I feel like this has happened so far in this. Okay, good. All right. So I'm not alone.
That's the tricky part.
Yeah? I feel like I'm being quizzed. Can the lecturer figure out how to keep the blackboard in place? Okay. So I think we probably won't get, I was gonna talk a little bit about some inferences on binary rates and things like that. I don't think we're gonna have time to get to it. So I suspect that the last day we will cover a sort of the observational state of the field. And that's probably when we'll just switch to some PowerPoint presentations and I can sort of go through where things are and where we're headed soon. Okay, any questions so far? Good. All right. So in the beginning, I just to point out the references that I mostly used for this, I tried to stick with a notation in Hartle's gravity book. I can send the actual links to this, and I used a little bit from Schutz's GR book, which is quite old at this point. All right, so GR, as it seems like most of you know, is a theory of gravity that actually relates geometry, and specifically curvature of space-time, to gravity. And I think it's fair to say that in most cases with gravity, you know, our experiences with gravity here on Earth, certainly Newton's theory of gravity is more than adequate to describe it. It's also fair to say that for the most part, we experience static gravity situations. I mean, the Earth's gravitational field is what it is. The acceleration near Earth is G. You don't even have to worry about tidal forces if you're close to Earth here. And in fact, even the Earth around the Sun, even though that's a dynamic system, and in principle, you know, is emitting gravitational waves, actually, the Earth's mass compared to the Sun is quite small. So it's pretty reasonable to assume that the Sun is providing a static gravitational field that the Earth is passing through. But what we want to talk about really in this lecture series are situations where the gravity is far more dynamic. So we have the canonical example will be compact binary systems. So these are systems which they needn't be this, but for the sake of everything we'll discuss, will basically be equal mass systems. And compact in the sense that their radius is extremely small compared to their mass. So a perfect example is, of course, binary black holes. Black holes are point-like objects, but of course they have some sense of extendedness through the event horizon and other important surfaces. And so these systems, you know, not only are they extremely massive, but they can actually get very close to one another and be orbiting one another very rapidly, and in fact approaching the speed of light. And so that's what makes systems like this highly relativistic dynamic systems, where we really need GR to describe them, and where also gravitational waves are an important consequence. Okay. So just to establish a little bit of background. So in a linearized treatment of GR, because we don't really need anything for any of the stuff that we don't need anything beyond this for any of the things we're going to be discussing. It's possible to good approximation to write the metric, which I'll talk more about this in a second, as the flat space metric plus some perturbation. And this flat space metric is what we know from special relativity. So in nice Cartesian coordinates, is just -1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1. So one's along the diagonal, of course, but with the time coordinate with a negative sign. So keep in mind, the metric, of course, tells us how to compute distances in space-time. That's going to be extremely relevant for gravitational wave detection. So in general, the dot product between two vectors, for example, in special relativity and in general relativity will involve this metric. Now, in special relativity, this is the metric we would use. In linearized gravity, we'll use this metric, which includes a possible perturbation on top of the flat space metric. And just to sort of be explicit about it, if we were to write a dot product between two vectors, A and B, then we would write this as this, where there's an assumption that repeated indices that are up and down are summed over. So you end up getting a scalar out of this equation. If we just have, if G is just...
upstairs beta? Because you've got two upstairs alpha.
Thank you. Pete, feel free if I make a mistake, point it out, thank you. I don't want people to write some nonsensical thing in the notes because I put an alpha instead of a beta. Thank you. Who was that? Thank you. If I had like stickers or bonus points that I could give out, I would.
John Wheeler, when that happened, he'd take the smallest coin in his pocket and he gave it to whoever the person was that did it.
All right. So if you're going to put me against John Wheeler, I will be broke really fast. Let's all be clear about that. I'll be out of money. All right, so a dot product is a sum over it looks like a standard dot product that people will have learned even in undergrad. This metric sits in the middle. And in general, it will be some complicated function. In special relativity, it's a pretty straightforward function. And the important part to get on to gravitational waves is, even in an infinitesimal sense, if we imagine a line element, so a small displacement vector, ds, dotted with ds, I'll put the arrows over just so that people are explicit that these things are vectors. This can be written as, if it were just the special relativity metric, minus dt squared plus dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. And we would be able to do sort of standard calculus with this to calculate, for example, the distance, square root of this. So this would be the normal sense of a distance. So in...
We're talking about the moment that there's no perturbations, because that's just...
Yes, just SR, yes. So H alpha beta is zero. So we can talk about, without any actual derivation, I just want to show you a sort of general solution for perturbations relevant for gravitational waves. So H alpha beta for a gravitational wave passing, traveling along the z direction. So if z is facing out of the board, coming out of the board at you. A general form for this is I'll write both polarizations. We have a function, actually two functions, f plus and f cross, which correspond to two polarization states for gravitational waves. That's it's a wave-like solution, a function of t minus z, so something that sort of keeps a constant shape as it's propagating.
Different functions, fx and ft?
Fx and f cross. Sorry for the bad handwriting. F plus and f cross. So this is a cross, not a t.
Okay.
So two polarizations, yeah.
What do those functions depend on? Which coordinates?
So in this case, that's a great question. In this case, the assumption is that it is a plane wave. So just like in electromagnetism, the sort of, you know, wave profile is the same anywhere in x and y. Thank you. I meant to say that as I was writing it. Good catch.
So it's just the function of t minus z.
Exactly. Yeah, and doesn't depend on the other spatial coordinates. In principle, of course, it does. But in the case of gravitational waves, what we'll find later is, you know, these things are extremely far away. The plane wave approximation in linear gravity is completely reasonable for a source observing it here at Earth.
Sorry, is that a function of color or product? Is it f cross of t minus c?
It's a function, yes. Of t minus c, yes.
Okay.
Function, yes. Good. Okay. So, if we wanted to detect gravitational waves in the simplest possible form, so knowing that we have some function like this, and by the way, this could be lots of different things. So I mean, this is sort of any standard wave solution. It could be a Gaussian wave packet, it could be a sinusoidal wave. In the end, what we'll find is that all of the sources that LIGO have detected so far are well described as a sinusoidal wave, though the frequency is somewhat slowly changing. So you can think of this as a sinusoidal oscillation, and we'll get to that more later. If we want to detect gravitational waves, we could do it by having essentially two points, and I'll put one at the origin, and I'll put one some distance L star away. And without any perturbations, of course, if these things are at rest and we're, you know, at rest with respect to them, computing their distances is how you would precisely expect to compute distance between two points. With a perturbation on top of this, we'll actually figure out this distance L by taking the integral over the line separating them along the x-axis. If the initial separation is L star, we'll integrate the line element along that path, which in this case, we're just talking about the x direction. So we get the integral from 0 to L star of dx gxx dx all square root. And this is one plus, in this case, the f plus function . And there's an assumption baked into essentially all of this that this perturbation is small in this coordinate system compared to one, right? So that whatever's on top of this, the perturbation coming from here is much, 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 much less than one. So in this case, you can expand this out and just get L star times 1 plus 1/2 of f plus t minus z. So if this perturbation is in fact 0, you get the distance that you would expect it to be. You get the distance between these two points is L star. But in general, if there's some perturbation on top of this, a time-dependent perturbation, you'll find that the distance between these two points calculated in this way is actually changing as a function of time. And I won't talk about gravitational wave detectors because you're going to hear about that tomorrow. But you'll find out how gravitational wave detectors are essentially probing not only this direction along, not only this distance along one direction, but also simultaneously along another direction to end up with basically probing this full amplitude of the gravitational wave. Okay, so it's worth showing this. I will actually try to use the computer and see how that works out. I'm sure most of you have already seen this, but I want to give you a sense of what it looks like. Magic. Whoa. Did I hit a bookmark?
I thought you'd rented up ad space on your computer while
you're doing these lectures. Yeah. My wife sometimes uses my laptop and she's bookmarked all kinds of fun stuff.
Armadillo?
Where?
Behind you.
It's whatever the Ubuntu. An anteater. Yeah, that sounds better.
Thank you.
Okay. So if you imagine the gravitational wave propagating out of the screen, maybe. This is what the first 10 years of LIGO was like. Right? Way more than 10th, yes. Thank you. A long time. Okay, so if you imagine a gravitational wave passing through the screen, and in this case, again, this is sort of a plane wave approximation, you can see this is a sort of sinusoidal oscillation done probably reasonably poorly, so don't critique it too much. You won't get bonus points for critiquing this particular plot. I draw the line at that. So if you imagine looking at just one of these little squares, right, you're seeing that the x and y coordinate distance is changing as a function of time. So you can imagine that you put as your function of time in here a sinusoidal wave traveling in the z direction coming out of the board. And any one little square, you know, stretches and squeezes as much as any one little square over here. That's, of course, what it means to be a plane wave. There's no x, y difference in the wave profile. The other thing that you want to note is if you were to take and sort of measure the distance between like the edge of a square and its nominal state, while it's oscillating, you'd get some value. The value that you get in terms of a fractional change in distance is also the same if you were to take a bigger square. So if you were to instead, you know, calculate the distance from what would nominally be the grid at each side of the screen, you would get the same fractional change. But of course, what you're observing is a much larger absolute change. And it is this larger absolute change that was really required to make gravitational wave detection successful, which I'm guessing you'll hear about. I feel bad, like I should be using the computer for more than just this one slide, but that's it. Yeah.
Does the metric perturbation have to be traceless? Or is it?
Sorry, say it again.
Does the metric perturbation have to be traceless?
So this is a gauge where it is traceless and transverse. In general, you can have other perturbations.
Yeah.
This is the one that best describes the gravitational wave, and there's a lot of details in this that are not going to be coming through in this lecture,
yeah.
In terms of how you would actually. So this is an accurate picture, and this calculation is sensible. But what LIGO is actually doing is a little bit more complicated because it's actually a photon orbit or a photon path.
Wait, did you say the tracelessness is gauge dependent?
No. So this will always. So this is traceless.
Yeah.
But you could have. I think it's true that you could have. I mean, in principle, you could study perturbations that don't have this form. But the gravitational wave perturbation form is this.
Plus and the cross notation for the polarizations. I've never seen that combination, so I'm not sure what kind of polarization modes we're talking about.
Yeah, so that's another good question. And I meant to have another slide that shows the two different modes. So in the end, what you saw there in these coordinates, if I define z coming out, would be plus polarization. If you wanted to do cross, it's rotated 45 degrees. So it would be like a stretching. I don't have anything easy to show you. But stretching and squeezing diagonally, basically.
Okay.
Take the grid and like grab it like this at 45 degrees. The plus and cross don't have to necessarily be related to one another. They're independent polarizations. So in principle, you could measure some signal in plus and some completely different thing in cross. In actual fact, I'm not going to get into any of these details, but for binaries, you tend to have circularly polarized things, so the two functional forms are quite similar, just out of phase. Okay, so for a reasonably idealized source of gravitational waves, where there are probably lots of caveats on this, but certainly The system has velocities that are much less than the speed of light. You're looking at long wavelengths, and an observer is some reasonably far distance away. And I apologize, the way this is usually written has indices up instead of down, so we're actually going to be talking about the inverse metric instead of the metric. But okay, so normally one can get a sort of weak field approximation to a gravitational wave source. Oops. As this. And what this is defined as the second mass moment. So, by the way, I should point this out. The ij in this case refer to just the space indices. So starting at one. So it doesn't include the time index.
Plus minus r?
T minus r.
Oh.
And there's more. I've not finished the equation. Sorry. Yeah.
You also assume that Newton's constant equals 1.
Yes. Sorry. Thank you. Good. I meant to say that out loud. So I'm assuming speed of light and Newton constant is 1. Thank you. So mu in this case, which is a function, I should actually just say maybe a function of. It can actually be a function of everything. Not everything, but space and time. So mu is the standard mass density. So it is what you would normally write down for a density profile. In other courses, it may have been called rho, I guess, depending on.
Shouldn't I then be time dependent? Okay, it has to be the degree of it.
Sorry, say it again?
Answer my own question.
Okay, good. Those are the best questions. Anyway, so this is the second mass moment. And we can calculate, again,
is it off the trace?
So in this case, no. I don't think so. When we calculate the power formula, it will take off the trace. I was uncertain about that myself, but I'm pretty sure this is the case. So you'll see. You'll
anything if it's just a spherical oscillation. I think you have to take off the trace.
Oh, and by the way, yeah. So let me come back to that because we'll see that in a second. So I was going to explain what all this is. So this is the second mass moment. The I double dot. So the double dot's time derivative in this case. So the standard time derivative.
Then after that multiplied by T minus R? Or is it a function?
A function of T minus R. You know what, let me just erase that part.
Relatedly, it looks like IJ is integrated over all space, as opposed to time, space-time, all over the entirety of the three space, as it were. So how is it R dependent? And what is R being measured with respect to? Like, what's your origin?
So I will introduce a system and we'll calculate this exactly here in a second.
Okay.
In fact, let's do it right now.
Yeah, you got three levels of boards at each thing. So if you wanted to save those things, you can just raise it and bring another one down.
Pro tip. No, that's good. I'll do that from now on. The courses that I, well, the last 3 years, all the courses I've taught have been, I'm at Penn State, and in case you didn't know that, it's a really big university. So the last 3 years, the courses I've taught have been like 250 students each. So needless to say, it's all PowerPoint, unfortunately. So I miss having to use the board, but I'm a little bit out of practice. Okay. So if we imagine the following system, which is a canonical kind of thing for calculating stuff about compact binaries. Make sure we have a right-hand coordinate system. X, Y, Z. My drawing skills may not be great. What I'm trying to do here is put two masses that are in the XY plane. So a circular orbit in the XY plane. Should have made it more elliptical for perspective. You have to take my word for it. Some distance r from an origin here. And so this is also distance r. And we'll let the mass of each object be m. And we'll assume that these things are going around one another with angle. So the angle of, well, I'll just write that the orbital frequency is omega. So a given angle off the axis will be omega times t as it's going around and around and around. So initially when we set this up, we'll just pretend that there's some contrived example where you can actually set up these two-point masses and have them in this orbit sort of by construction. So this is not, you know, this is not assuming at the moment that they're following dynamics from gravity, but rather that you've basically constructed a machine with two masses at the end of infinitely strong, infinitely light rods or something, keeping them at a distance r, okay? That's the physical picture here. So it doesn't really represent very accurately anything in nature. But you could imagine building this, right? You build this in your workshop. You know, you put bowling balls on the end of super strong, you know, carbon fiber rods or something, and all of a sudden you've got one of these gravitational wave generators. So that's the system we're studying. So it's kind of contrived, but it will be pretty relevant for binaries here in a second. The x position, so written in terms of I guess polar coordinates, that make this a little bit easier. So also we'll label this, one of these can be A and B.
Did you mean for that orbit to be in the XY plane?
It did, yes. Shall I redraw it? Yeah, the orbit is in the XY plane. So Z, let me start with Z. Z, or Z, that's what you prefer. Took me 2 years after getting, so I was here as a postdoc. Took me 2 years after getting back to the United States before I stopped saying Z. Annoyed everyone in my lecture so much. I got used to it, I like it, but I've gone back to Z, I'm sorry. Couldn't take all the harassment. Z is zero for both cases. So ZA, ZB, zero. So it is in the XY plane. And we can write XA of T as R cos omega T. YA of T as R sine omega T. And the other ones hopefully are related just by XB is minus XA and YB is minus Y. So, this is what we want to evaluate. We want to evaluate first the components of this that are relevant, and then take the time derivative. So what we'll do is assume that these are in fact point masses. And I can talk a little bit later about circumstances in real life under where that's relevant and okay. Actually for LIGO, you can get very far with just assuming that they're point masses. And in fact, you can really understand the majority of our results, at least in a really good qualitative sense, even from the pretty simple picture of the binary that we're presenting here. So we'll get there. Okay, so if I have these as point masses, I'll just make them delta functions. So the mass density then should be able to be written something like x minus xa of t delta y minus ya of t and delta z minus 0. So that's for A, and then you get the same exact thing, but for B. Oh, there's a, sorry, mass A in front plus mass B delta x minus xB of t delta y minus yB of t delta z minus 0.
When you said xb is minus xa, yb is also minus ya.
Ah.
You said the minus.
I did. I said and didn't write it. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So, with some hopefully correct algebra, the xx component is m r squared 1 plus 2, sorry, no, 1 plus cos 2 omega t. And this whole thing. You end up having one of these double angle trick identities that come in. You can trust me or do the math yourself. So that's why there's a 2 in front of the omega.
Each m stands for the IXX complement.
Sorry.
Or which m? MA or M?
I said it out loud and didn't write it. Thank you. I'm going to assume MA is equal to MB. Very good. Very important, in fact. Thank you. You guys are on your toes. So I like it. Any mistake I make is intentional to make sure you're paying attention. Nothing? All right. Good. Yeah, I'm going to assume MA is equal to MB in this case. There's the formula later where I won't repeat the derivation or whatever, but you'll see the sort of first order stuff worked out for a non-equal mass. And it's important, because it's actually what we'll be looking at in one of our exercises. Okay.
The confusion here is that you've just written down an equation for I, XX, that is space independent. Not on that board, where you wrote IXX equals. And so there's a capital R, but that's just the radius of your thing. It's not spatially dependent I. This is confusing to me because earlier you had I as a function of a spatial variable.
Which then integrates
over. Yeah.
So we're going to get HIJ equals 2 over R, I of T minus R.
Yeah, so the spatial dependence goes when you integrate.
When do you integrate H?
Have I written I?
You've got I.
Yeah.
That's after integrating.
No.
No, because you've
Oh, yes, yes, sorry, yes, yes. After doing this?
Yes.
Yes.
But that's just a function of at the origin.
It's a function of...
You're putting the origin where the source is, right?
Yes, I'm putting the origin right where the source is, yes.
So that's t, but then r is zero there, so it's the same as a function of t. T is the same as t minus r at the source.
Yes.
Okay.
And then you see it later because it takes a time.
It takes time to get to you.
Okay.
That's why there's the delay of t minus, exactly. Good. So the that's good enough for that one. The I, so again, similar procedure here. XY is MR squared times, it's even simpler. Sine 2 omega t and IYY is MR squared times 1 minus cos.
So if you divide all of them by 2, or times all of them by 2. Because you got cos squared is half 1 plus cos 2 omega t. And the same with the sine. I don't think it matters, but.
Sorry, say it again.
Should all of those be divided by 2?
You have both of them.
You might be double up from two masses.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah, sorry, the expression from, up there. So it comes, exactly. Good. Thank you. Good. Okay. So, taking... to evaluate the time derivative, second time derivative of this, and then calculating hij. Okay. If I write one more line down there, people can see it. All right. Please note that minus sign here. When I was first going through this, I didn't see the minus sign. I kept getting an answer that was different than Hartle, and I'm like, he's not wrong. There's a minus sign on front. So minus 8 and then cos 2 omega t So here we put in the t minus r here explicitly, so that you can be some distance r away.
Is that 8 pi squared, or did one of the omegas escape?
Omega.
Secondary question, how did omega escape, one of the omegas escape the trig functions?
Differentiate.
Oh, right, of course.
Yeah, there's a double, yep. And then there's a minus sign for this one. Oops. I want to make sure that I get you this one right, because I'm going to give you a problem that you work out later. If I screwed up a sign, you're going to hate me. And then there's another zero over here, sorry. And zeros across the bottom. Okay. So we'll come back to a more realistic scenario for a compact binary, but I want to pause and work out some actual numbers from this. So if we have, if we imagine taking our picture of this system, which I said was a kind of contrived system where we're putting masses on the end of rods, but imagine that we set up that system and it's an actual binary, and so now it's going to evolve according to, well, general relativity ultimately. But in this first iteration, let's just pretend that, you know, Newtonian gravity is good enough. So basically, whatever the orbital frequency that you get from Newtonian gravity is, we'll put in for our omega. So we set up a system with some, you know, two masses of distance r from the origin. Kepler's law gives the relationship between r, m, and omega as m over 4 omega squared to the 1/3. So we can relate m, omega, and r. So then if we look at what the gravitational wave amplitude is, so obviously the trig functions, you know, oscillate between plus and minus 1, so I'm just looking at this term out front, and specifically just the absolute value of it. So what we get is h, which I'll just write h, I guess I'll write h with like this, is 2m squared over little r times big R. Now, we should stop and do a unit check. So I don't know that I said it out loud, but I should have. This gravitational wave amplitude really is a stretching and squeezing of space-time in a fractional sense. It's dimensionless. Okay, so it's just like a mechanical definition of strain, a fractional change in length. Now, looking at this, it sounds like most of you are GR aficionados, so you're comfortable with G equals 1, C equals 1 units. You do a quick unit check on this, and M and R, we've written the same units, so this comes out dimensionless. So,
do we have two distinct capital R's in this equation? I feel like we do.
So I don't think so.
In other words, you have R equals something divided by R.
It's omega.
It's omega.
Yeah, two equations.
So is it other equal signs saying?
You should have written it below. My bad. Yeah, this is just basically using, so this is just Kepler's law for circular orbits. Just to basically give us a physically realistic relationship between separation, orbital frequency, and mass, okay? So just Newtonian gravity, but like if you plopped these things down, you know, in this orbit, you know, unless they're really close together and whatever, they'll just orbit at this. Orbit like this forever, effectively forever. So, good. Now, sometimes you'll see formulas like this where instead of, you're like, maybe you've already spotted the inconsistency. So sometimes formulas like this will be written instead of like the radius to some origin, will be written as the actual separation distance between the binary. So you'll see things that might be off by a factor of 2 here. Just if you look at Wikipedia or something, you might see that. So here, r is really the distance to the origin. So 2r is the separation distance. Not that that's a big deal for our discussion today, but just in case you find formulas somewhere else. OK, so who knows pop quiz? I don't have any. There's no grading. I have no bonus points. I'm making this all up, right? Like, I wish I had. I should have brought cookies or something. Would that have been effective? All right. Maybe tomorrow?
Yeah.
You can beg the bistro for some cookies. We'll see. All right, so who knows the mass of the sun in kilometers? Come on, people! This is like...
That's a US class, because it's closer to a mile than to a kilometer.
All right, who knows it in miles? I think either. Come on, mass of the sun in how about the mass of the sun in seconds?
Kilometers.
Almost. Yeah, there's always that factor of 2.
Yeah.
radius, diameter, all these things. Yeah, 1.5. 1.5 kilometers. Okay, good. Now, how about the radius of the sun in kilometers? That's a slightly more standard one. It's the normal unit one might measure the sun in. 7 × 10⁵? I hope. Yeah, sure. All right, we'll go with that. All right, here's where I'm going with this. Here's where I'm going with this. So we'll imagine a very contrived example where we have two suns. That are just touching, because, you know, that's going to happen. There are lots of reasons why that would never happen. So this is a very contrived example. But if we have our two suns, so in this case, our R is R, the radius of the sun. And M is the mass of the sun. Then we can plug these numbers in. So H is 1.5, so one of my m's, over, I'm not sure why I wrote it this way, I thought maybe I was getting at a point, but yeah, we'll see. 1.5 over 7 × 10⁵ times 2 × 1.5 over, who knows the closest star?
Sun.
The sun.
All right, we're done here. I'm glad you all feel very proud of yourself. All right, good. That's great, that's right. All right, so who knows the closest star that is not the sun? Yes, yes, yeah, exactly, yeah. And they're different by a little wee bit, right? So, roughly in whatever units you know it.
4 light years.
4 light years, yeah, that's pretty good. In seconds, no. 4 light years. So 4.2 is what I found on Wikipedia, which is bound to be right. Anyway, in kilometers it's a big number. 10 to the 13? In round numbers? So if the binary star system that is closest to us happened to get to the point where the stars were touching, I actually don't know the mass of any of the stars, but we can assume that they're solar mass. If they managed to get close enough and, you know, and for some reason this actually worked, which it wouldn't, because the stars would be ripped apart from tidal forces, or there'd be lots of reasons why this would never actually happen. But imagine that happened. We'd get an H of, if I've done this right, 6 × 10⁻¹⁹. So in some sense, that's like the most optimistic scenario ever for gravitational waves, I would argue. I don't know, that's maybe not true. There are probably something that could maybe be better, more optimistic.
So what is little r?
Little r is the distance, thank you, distance to the observer. So little r, if I'm directly above or below the system, would be z, effectively.
From the origin
to the observer, yeah. Sorry, thank you. So little r is the distance to some observer far away. And 6 × 10⁻¹⁹ is the rough order of magnitude for this pretty contrived system of two suns touching one another at the closest possible distance that we know other stars than the sun to be. Okay, so now what if we took instead two 30 solar mass black holes, chosen arbitrarily, no particular reason. And again, we'll have them be touching, which we'll talk about why this is also sort of silly, but actually, this case, far less silly than the stars. This is very close to realistic. They really will get almost this close together before they plunge.
No, black hole is the event horizon.
Yes, event horizon of the Schwarzschild metric. Okay. Yes, which is wrong, because this isn't an isolated black hole. But humor me. To give some rough sort of order of magnitude sense that people can wrap their heads around. So, here, we put this at R of 2m, and the mass is 30 m sun. And we'll put it at 10 to the 9 light years, so a billion light years, for no reason. Watch, I think it's 10 to the 22 kilometers. Again, in round numbers here. So now we have H is equal to 30 over 60. So I'm just using the R equals 2m relationship. And then 30 times 2 times 1.5 over 10 to the 22. And this should come out right about 10 to the minus 21. Yes, thank you.
What's the distance in kilometers?
10 to the 22, sorry. Good, thank you.
Why is 1.5 there? No?
Because I'm doing it in kilometers. So this was a ratio, so I could have multiplied top and bottom by kilometers.
Yeah.
1.5 is the radius, sorry, is the mass of the sun in kilometers. And I have 30 solar masses. Did I do that right?
Yeah.
Yeah? Yeah? No, I'm glad you're checking. I could have screwed it up, but that's where it comes from. So I've got 30 solar mass black hole. A single solar mass is 1.5 kilometers. I really should have like one point. Did I miss a factor of 1.5? I don't think so. Sorry?
There is an extra factor of
1.5.
Be 1.5 squared, right?
Squared,
yeah. Well,
because it's normalizing the denominator for the size.
Yeah. I think this is right. If not, I think this is right.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're talking about the order here, but thank you for checking. 10 to the minus 21. Okay, so this, as we'll learn later, is actually, in some sense, the most optimistic, realistic prediction for gravitational waves that people had going into the construction of LIGO. It just so happens that 230 solar masses at about a billion light years away gives 10 to the minus 21. And that was, in fact, the first gravitational wave source.
Potentially, you could do some very crude entropic estimates to get it to be the mass of the electron in Planck units, which is the same number. So it's essentially the same ratio as the Planck as the electron mass to the Planck mass.
By
a long sequence of quasi arguments.
Okay, I had no idea. I would take your word for it.
So is there a reason to believe that this would be somehow typical in our universe for black hole mergers?
I'll talk a little bit about rates later. And let you come to what you think about that conclusion yourself. In actual fact, just to sort of jump the gun, we didn't really know a lot about black hole rates. Like, the estimates there were all over the place. What we will go into detail on is the neutron star rate. And there we have, like, reasonable evidence, observational, you know, data to make statements. But I'll try to relate it back to this. Okay. So that's a typical amplitude. Now, how small is that? So my favorite analogy, you hear a lot of different analogies for how small that is. My favorite one is that a typical person is about 1.5 meters in height, give or take. And the Milky Way is about 1.5 times 10 to the 21 meters across, again, give or take. So the ratio of like my height to the Milky Way is the 10 to the minus 21. So that gives you a sense of the very, very, very tiny strain. So like the plane wave approximation across the Milky Way may not quite be right. I haven't calculated that, but assuming it is, you could imagine that the Milky Way, when this gravitational wave passed through, stretched and squeezed by my height. And that's what was measured on Earth. So a very small number. Okay. Now, none of this, so we've kind of like basically given a system where you can, you in some contrived way, put two masses in a circular, you know, basically circular motion around one another. And initially we didn't, you know, specify what the frequency was. We assumed you'd built some machine that could spin them. We put in Kepler's law, which comes again from just sort of Newtonian gravity, to motivate what a physically reasonable relationship between R and omega and M would be. And then studied a couple of systems, like basically at sort of an instant of time, what kind of amplitudes you might expect at a distance that makes sense here on Earth. So now we need to sort of talk a little bit more about how this works. So in fact, this free system, if you have really a binary, not some contrived machine that you're able to control, if you had a machine, so even if it were a perfectly frictionless, like ideal machine, like you could spin these two masses on, connected to these two rods, there was no, it was in a vacuum, this machine was totally frictionless, it would actually be losing energy due to gravitational waves. So the warping of space time around it that propagates away will carry away energy. So unless you put energy into that machine, it will eventually slow down. Now, you'll be able to calculate like how long that would take for some reasonable thing you could build on Earth and find out that you don't have that kind of patience. But in the case of systems like this, where things are super close together, the densest possible configuration of energy and you know, otherwise pretty physically realistic things, you'll find that actually the energy loss is dramatic and quick. And the what that means is that the orbit itself is changing as a function of time. Yeah.
My understanding is that if you've got a star binary, a stellar binary, generally
like main sequence stars or something, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The masses of the two are very unequal. Normally, they're not roughly, they're not the same order of magnitude, the masses of the stars. So how, we were talking earlier about how likely it was to have these two black holes that close together. How likely is it that you'll have them having the same exact mass? And how quickly does this go to heck?
I didn't think that the binary function was super steep. I thought it was actually somewhat uniform, right? I don't remember my stellar evolution well enough for the mass ratio distribution.
I remember reading somewhere that it was that a lot of them, there was a bigger star and a smaller star. So like, if Jupiter was a bit bigger enough to be a star, that would be fair. You know, if it was just big enough to be a star, that would be a fairly standard thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot we still don't know, and I'll talk a little bit more about some of the astrophysics on this, probably not today, but before Friday. There's a lot the people are still sorting out with the black hole scenario. So with neutron stars, which not to jump the gun, there's reasonable, people have reasonable models for why they form at rough, you know, at certainly at a minimum mass, and why they can't get too big. So with neutron stars, you really do have this pretty narrow window of mass ratios that makes sense, and the mass ratio is of order one, right? Because if they were any smaller, the neutron star wouldn't form. If they were any bigger, you get a black hole. So for double neutron star systems, there's just a really pretty clear physical argument, you know, that it comes from nuclear physics and GR that leads you to that conclusion. For black holes, certainly minimum things exist. Like you have, if it's too light, it'll become a neutron star, or maybe not even a neutron star, maybe it's a white dwarf. So you definitely have lower limits. Observationally, there interestingly enough seems to be a gap in black hole masses. In principle, you could have a black hole form right above the maximum mass of the neutron star, which, you know, is maybe around two solar masses, I think, at this point. Some observed it around there. And we probably don't think that they get much bigger than that. But observationally, black holes, we haven't seen anything less than five solar masses, not only from gravitational waves, but also from electromagnetic observations and X-ray sources. So there was kind of a gap there that I think people have ideas about, but is a completely open thing. And in fact, one of the things we're hoping to do with LIGO eventually is see if we can measure a source in that gap. Because I think it would help us understand some of the stellar evolution. Okay. So the next part of this, again, we're not going to go into anything super in-depth here, but I want to motivate the fact that, in fact, energy is carried away from this. So if you really did construct a binary that was free to orbit, you know, not attached to rods, it's going to give off energy, and that's going to change the dynamics. And essentially, what's going to happen is the orbit will shrink. Excuse me. So I'll go over here. So here is where this traceless quadrupole moment is going to show up for sure. The luminosity, so the energy given off as a function of per unit time from gravitational wave, again in this pretty simplified picture of weak sources, slow motion, et cetera, has an expression that can also be written in terms of something like this second mass moment. And I'm not, this will not be derived in any way at all. I'll explain what that slash means here in a second. And here we've got a triple time derivative in time. The slash through this I is because, in actual fact, this has this trace removed.
The indices and the isolate as well, right?
Yes. Thank you. So I mean, other than this factor, it's what we calculated before for this particular system. And now we're gonna be taking the third time derivative. This is defined in some average sense. These angle bars mean averaging over a time scale. Typically what people talk about is a single orbital period in the case of one of these binaries. So you imagine averaging this over a binary orbital period. I think actually for this contrived system, the trig works out such that it kind of doesn't really matter. If you take the average, you get sine squareds and cosine squareds that you'll see come out. But that's the luminosity for this particular source. So that's how much energy is being given off in gravitational waves. And my understanding is that you have some time later where you can work through exercises. Yeah? All right, here's your first exercise. We can go over it tomorrow, but you're going to ask a question first. Go ahead.
Yeah. Isn't the period changing with time?
It is.
Does it change rapidly, in which case, how do you average over a period?
Yeah, it's a great question. It does. It changes not that rapidly, to be honest. Okay. I mean, at the very, very end, it does.
Right.
But at the very end, all of this goes out the window.
Yeah.
But it really is the very end. Like, this is an excellent approximation. We'll even find that for the binary black hole, which is almost the worst case scenario for this kind of thing to work, works decently well for several cycles. So as an exercise tomorrow, we'll analyze it just from the Newtonian perspective and show that, in fact, it's kind of remarkably good. It's only when the thing is really close that this all falls apart, and then it falls apart in lots of ways, including that. But that's way beyond. I'll try to motivate some things, but really the only grasp one can get on that is to do things numerically. There are very sophisticated analytic techniques that allow one to model a waveform very close and through merger, but it is way beyond. Like it's a course. It's a year course itself.
Roughly how long is that final phase where this breaks down? Is it like a few seconds or is it?
No. Milliseconds. Or tens of milliseconds. It depends on the mass, right? But for the binary black hole, the whole thing lasted 200 milliseconds. And I would say that certainly the first 150 can be reasonably well described by Newtonian. There will be systematic errors in the parameter estimation. But in terms of being able to basically predict the dynamics, it's basically bang on.
Lasts like 200 milliseconds. What do you have before then?
Sorry?
If it only lasts for about 200 milliseconds, what do you have before then?
That's an excellent question, and I'm getting ahead of myself because I was going to introduce this, but thank you for bringing it up because the answer to the question needs explanation. In actual fact, it's probably been around for maybe billions of years. When we say something lasts a certain amount of time in LIGO, what we mean is that LIGO is only sensitive to certain frequencies. So it essentially has to evolve to a point where LIGO can actually detect it. And I'm going to give numbers on that later, but the point is that for any LIGO sources, it really is the very end that we observe. If we had different gravitational wave detectors, we could maybe observe the thing for a billion years, if you wanted to wait around that long. Your generation will have, like, your brains will be uploaded to computers and stuff, so maybe you'll get to do that, I don't know. Good luck. Okay. No, good question, thanks. When I say something like that, especially when I'm answering questions, because if I answer questions sort of ahead of what we're getting to in the lecture, and I may not realize that I've said something that I haven't covered yet, so keep asking. Okay. The luminosity for a binary system is, and of course this is the gravitational wave luminosity, there may be a reason why it's emitting other energy. So it's given by m squared r to the fourth omega to the sixth. And
it's two equal mass and r is from the center
mass or something? It's two equal mass. It's exactly the system that I erased. Yeah, exactly the system. This is exactly the system that we were describing before to make things simple. So equal mass, r is, you know, half the separation distance. It's in a circular orbit. I mean, we can, this assumes that omega, you know, these things are free parameters. If it's actually undergoing Newtonian, you know, orbits, then these parameters are coupled through that.
In what sense do you mean this as a luminosity, as like an energy?
Energy per unit time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so I'm not going to talk about the emission pattern at all. But in principle, it is not isotropic. It's highly isotropic, but not isotropic. But this is sort of averaged over any spatial. So I would like you to see if you can come up with something at least close to that. By going from the definition of the luminosity here and the binary that we had discussed so far. Try to do that later today, just to get a little bit of practice with it.
It may be doing it at the chainsaw, but it'll get done.
What's that?
It may be doing it at chainsaw, but it'll get done.
If you don't do it, I mean, you know, I have no stick, right? I have no carrots and no sticks. I do have a stick, that's true. I'm pretty.
I think I'm going up. What is the question we're trying to answer?
To try to derive this, at least get close to it. from the system that we, I mean, at least the scaling of m squared r to the fourth and omega to the sixth from the binary that we discussed.
In that case, what is this, the expectation value with respect to those?
Time average.
Ah, okay.
The expectation, so remember, the angle brackets are a time average. Time average over one orbit. So like cosine over an orbit. Cosine squared over an orbit is a half.
But it'll be constant in this case.
It will be. It will, yeah. It doesn't matter, but as you've pointed out. But anyway, you'll see that when you try it. You'll see that the time average doesn't. Okay. So if we were to try to put this into more useful terms, so again, this is sort of where you'd imagine keeping, letting m, r, and omega be free or independent from one another, right? So this is sort of the contrived machine example. In actual fact, they're related because if they're, you know, in orbit, they're gonna, at least in the early stages, just it'll look like Newtonian gravity. Of course, it isn't because it's losing energy and everything, but Kepler's law to an amazing approximation holds for several orbits. It's not a concern. So if you write this, if you use, again, from Kepler's law with a slightly different set of variables, so I'll use the fact that omega is 2 pi over the period p. So m, so r is equal to mp squared over 16 pi squared. I hope I have not screwed up factors. I don't think I have. From Kepler's law. So. So we can rewrite the luminosity for the gravitational wave, assuming that it's an actual binary system of stars, black holes, neutron stars, whatever, where Newtonian gravity is still describing the orbits well enough. And I'll spare you the algebra, but LGW is 128 over 5. You get such interesting numbers in this field. 4 to the 1/3. Pi m over p to the 10/3. So the gravitational wave emission is reducing the energy from the system. It does mean the period is not constant. You should be concerned about pretending that the period is constant, but like I said, the typical change in the period is very small over any given orbit, and it's only at the very end where that's going to really matter, so we're going to ignore all of that. But here you can get a sense of, like, at any given instant of time, what the characteristic luminosity of one of these binaries is. And we only have 5 minutes. I think I will, let's see. I think I'll stop there and take any additional questions that people have before I move on, because I think it'll be, otherwise we'll be right in the middle of something when we end. Yeah.
This might be a question that you can't really re-answer readily, but where does the 1/5 come from? I've been wondering ever since you wrote LGW, the 1/5 of this expectation.
I mean, if you want two exercises. This derivation shows up in a lot of places. It's actually been done incorrectly more than once throughout history. I can find your reference for the whole derivation. It's easy to get twos and pis and things misplaced.
There's five relatively unusual factors.
Yeah, you know, the field is full of very interesting ratios. When you go beyond just the simple Newtonian analysis, you get these crazy integer fractions of like 5 digits in the numerator and denominator. It's wonderful.
But I'm guessing that there's probably a second, because there's the second order Legendre function. Does the second Legendre function have some 5 in it? I'm just guessing.
Yeah, I don't actually remember myself, to be honest. But I like I said, we can find
it
the derivation.
Might be like a 2L plus 1 factor where L is 2 for spin 2 gravity, maybe.
Yes.
So you mentioned before that the distance 10 to the 9 light years was for the event in LIGO, right?
I think so, right?
So
about.
That means that is I was just checking the numbers. It's about 1,000 megaparsecs ish.
About 400 megaparsecs.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
Order 1,000.
Yeah, yeah.
as in physics. So how do you? So this reason this. The system has some redshift, and how do you deal with that?
Yeah, so another thing
especially
that I...
Especially like
Yep, you're totally right. So I was gonna put the caveat, and I'll show you a form with redshift in it. You're totally right. Redshift will affect what the observer sees. So whatever the system's masses are, in some sense, the observer observes a different mass due to redshift. Yeah, exactly. And for that particular system, it's a pretty small effect. It's 10%. Yeah.
But anyways, you should have a degeneracy between the redshift and the mass.
Yeah. Yes.
And
yes.
How do you say? What do you say about breaking this degeneracy?
Well, that's really hard and an interesting problem because if we can come up with, if we have an independent measurement of the distance, or the redshift, then we can pin things down better.
Maybe say you can triangulate the position and then.
Well, I mean, so you're right in the sense that, you know, there's a degeneracy between mass and redshift. You have, of course, you can assume some sort of cosmology and get a distance and get an estimate of the luminosity distance from gravitational waves. Because basically, you can predict the amplitude very accurately. So if you assume some cosmology, then you can associate the distance that you, the luminosity distance that you infer with a redshift and correct the mass that way. But if your goal is to not do that and to not make that, not have an explicit relationship for that, that relationship between distance and redshift, then there are other ways. And so we'll talk about this probably the last day. The neutron star merger that we measured, for example, came from a galaxy where we identified a host galaxy where redshift measurement had been made independently. So we had additional information because of that. Yeah. And that's something that can be done. It's easier with, the bottom line is it's easier with matter, is what it basically boils down to, because in GR, this mass just sort of scales and everything is difficult. But with matter, like actual masses matter. Right. Like the neutron star mass is a physical meaning that is independent of whether or not it's been shifted. Yeah.
And you also like measure the visible emission or something.
The electromagnetic emission?
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
Shift, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's harder, but in principle possible. It was not possible with the most recent event. There were no defined, there were no, I'm pretty sure that's true. It was not, the spectra was not adequate to do that. But maybe someday. Yeah.
I guess if there's like a cloud of gas around the galaxy that it comes from the...
Yeah, I mean, this is a model that, you know, people are working on actively to figure out how we learn more about that from the combination of electromagnetic and gravitational wave emission. But absolutely. Okay, so tomorrow we'll start back into the discussion of binaries under more realistic situations. We'll eventually get our way to how, where I want to go with this is, you know, I can sort of show you how this all fits together, and then I want to show you how we can actually extract the information from the signal we observe, which is what we mostly do on a day-to-day basis, instead of this. So enjoy lunch.